The oil and gas industry is providing more jobs for union workers. That has some worried about its influence on Pennsylvania's Democratic Party.
There goes any possibility of dissent or constructive concern over the environmental impacts with regard to the Democratic caucus.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the gas industry, unions, and political donations. And people whose diets have a higher carbon footprint tend to eat more calories.
They're also eating more meat, more beef than other meats like chicken, poultry.
Plus, President Trump has a plan to make America first in energy.
America will be allowed to access the vast energy wealth located right off our shores.
But there's a storm brewing over the proposal to expand drilling off of America's coasts. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Okay, let this number sink in. Just 20% of Americans are responsible for nearly half of the food-related greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. Rebecca Williams reports that's one of the findings of a new study.
These American diets with the biggest carbon footprint tend to include more red meat. Marty Heller is one of the study's authors. He's a senior research specialist with the University of Michigan's Center for Sustainable Systems.
One thing we do know is that diets in that fifth of the population are eating more food in total, more total calories. They're also eating more meat, more beef than other meats like chicken, poultry.
You might guess that people whose diets contribute the least to greenhouse gas emissions are vegans, but Heller says not necessarily.
There isn't any real standout, you know, identification for those diets, but certainly they're eating less meats.
Heller says meat production results in a lot of greenhouse gases.
Eating up higher up the trophic level, it takes a lot of feed to feed those animals through their lifetime. But then the one big thing that happens with cattle is this additional enteric methane emissions, which is a very potent greenhouse gas.
In other words, cows burp methane.
The microorganisms in those animals' stomachs that allow them to break down cellulosic materials that you and I can't digest happen to have a byproduct, which is methane.
So the big picture here, what happens if those Americans with the highest impact diets made a change?
If those high impact diets moved even just to an average emission diet, not going vegetarian or, you know, completely eliminating meat from their diet, but just moving to an average. And we found that shift would represent close to 10% of the emissions reductions that the U.S. requires in order to meet something like a Paris Agreement goal.
He says that average diet would mean more fruits and veggies, less meat, especially red meat, and fewer calories. Heller says they studied greenhouse gas emissions related to food production up to the farm level. They didn't include steps like processing, transportation, cooking, and so on. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
As many try to reduce their energy use, maybe eat less red meat, in an effort to stave off climate change, a majority of Pennsylvania voters say climate change is causing problems now. 39% say they've been affected personally. The numbers come from a recent poll by Franklin and Marshall College and State Impact Pennsylvania. Some respondents, like Sharon Tapp, say they believe climate change is behind harsh weather they've endured lately. The lifelong resident of York says she thinks rainstorms in her area have become more intense. Sometimes water has flooded her home.
It started becoming an issue, I would think, about 10 years ago, and it was happening to me fairly frequently. But I ended up then spending some money and some time getting some waterproofing done in my basement. And for the last 2 years, I haven't had any issues.
Scientists are researching whether climate change is to blame for any individual storm. But the world's leading climate experts agree it is causing more extreme weather generally, from heavy rainfall to more frequent heat waves. And according to the poll, that sentiment is echoed by many residents across Pennsylvania.
Music.
President Trump wants to open up nearly all of the country's oceans to oil and gas drilling.
We're creating a new offshore oil and gas leasing program. America will be allowed to access the vast energy wealth located right off our shores.
The idea is to fuel America's energy independence, or what the Trump administration has been calling America's energy dominance. In January, a new five-year plan was proposed by Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke to start the process. It would allow companies to drill all along the Atlantic coast from Maine to Florida, along the Gulf Coast from Florida to Texas, the Pacific Coast, Alaska, all of it. It's unprecedented. And the plan has a lot of people who live and work in states along the shore and others really concerned. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier and Julie Grant spoke with reporter Tim Kama of The Hill, who's been following this story.
How are states responding?
Very quickly after the administration put this out on January 4th, there was sort of a big wave of opposition from state governors, state legislators, a lot of other people in these coastal states. All of the governors along the West Coast and almost all of the governors along the East Coast expressed at least some opposition or concerns.
This is outrageous, obviously.
It's just insane and grossly irresponsible to go chasing some last drop of oil, exposing our beautiful beaches.
We don't want it.
They all wanted the Interior Department to sort of immediately take their waters out of the plan and ban offshore drilling for the waters near their states.
So Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke met with Florida Governor Rick Scott, and then he pulled Florida off the list. How did that happen?
A matter of days after Ryan Zinke put out this expansive plan, he flew down to Tallahassee.
Well, everybody, great to be in Florida again.
Met with Rick Scott, the Republican governor of Florida, and that same day announced that the waters near Florida would be taken off the table.
We are going to take the new oil platforms, new oil gas platforms off the table, off the Florida coastlines. And so for Floridians, we are not drilling off the coast of Florida.
A lot of political observers saw Secretary Zinke's action as trying to help out Governor Scott in a Senate race and try to sort of beef up his environmental credentials, which is an area where Bill Nelson, the current senator, sort of has been a lot more outspoken throughout his whole time in Congress.
So do states have authority to block on their own along shorelines, or is each state going to have to make its case with the Department of Interior?
Yeah, you know, these decisions are ultimately up to the Department of Interior. The law governing this, which is the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, says that Interior is supposed to listen to state governors and, you know, coastal communities and the like. And oftentimes in the past, that's essentially amounted to a gubernatorial veto of offshore drilling off a particular state's coast. That's not necessarily always the case, but it's, you know, it's in Interior's best interest to do that. If a state really wanted to, they can make it very difficult for companies to drill off of their coast. You know, the waters are owned by the federal government, but if you try to put, for example, docking facilities to bring the oil back onshore, a state could do a lot of things to make that very difficult, and the drillers or the oil companies or even the federal government might not have many options to prevent that.
The deal Florida brokered triggered tweets from lawmakers from coastline states who want the same thing.
New York's Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo quickly pushed back on Twitter. New York doesn't want drilling off our coast either, he tweeted.
So if almost none of these governors really want drilling to happen in their states, what's the Department of Interior's response likely to be, do we think?
You know, for the Trump administration, this plan overall has been about, you know, opening up access for drillers to more areas than were available before. So in a way, if they open up any new areas or in any way spur any drilling, then that's a victory for them. And where you might see that, for example, is off the northern Arctic coast of Alaska. President Obama took Alaska out of his most recent drilling plan, and it's likely to stay in this current drilling plan. The governor in Alaska and most of Alaska's leaders do support drilling off the Arctic coast in Alaska. You know, so if the Trump administration can open up that to drilling, then that would be a victory. Of course, a smaller victory than opening up all the coasts, Atlantic, Pacific, et cetera. But really, if you're measuring from, you know, the current state of affairs and the Obama administration state of affairs, then from the perspective of trying to open more areas to drilling, then there's probably room for at least some sort of victory there.
There's almost a different culture in the coastal communities than, say, in many other places around the country where you see drilling. You know, particularly, there's just a lot more money on the coasts, right? And so people who might not like to see drilling, are we going to see a stronger political fight against drillers?
Opposition to drilling in general and to the Trump administration's plan in particular is pretty strong along the coast in general. To them, the possibility of an oil spill like the 2010 spill and that BP rig in the Gulf of Mexico, just the thought of that is something disastrous for them, be it oil on the beaches or even just the perception that this could happen. And then also the impact on wildlife, the impact on fishing.
You know, I feel like that's really the backstory to this whole discussion. That's sort of like part of the subtext of all these fights is the Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah, definitely. That's fresh in people's memory. It was less than 8 years ago, the biggest environmental disaster in a while. And yeah, like you said, this is really a major part of everything running through this whole offshore drilling debate, be it, you know, opening more areas to drilling, be it changing rules. That's really at the top of everybody's mind is preventing another Deepwater Horizon.
Tim Kama is a reporter at The Hill. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant and Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more of their conversation at trumponearth.org. That's where you'll find all of the episodes of the podcast as we track changes in environmental policy under the Trump administration. That's trumponearth.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Eastern brook trout need cold, clean water to thrive. That means reducing runoff from roads and farms. Fortunately, farmers love them.
Talking to a farmer about eastern brook trout is a much more productive conversation than talking to them about the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay.
Later on the Allegheny Front, making a case for conservation in Pennsylvania, one species at a time. Stay tuned. Across Pennsylvania, big natural gas pipelines and the plants that use that gas are under construction. Many of those construction jobs have gone to labor unions. And now unions are using their political clout to advocate for the oil and gas industry. They're a powerful ally in labor-friendly Pennsylvania. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
Ken Broadbent is walking through a big warehouse-type room lined with racks of pipes, heating and cooling equipment, and welding supplies.
Over here is a rigging and pipe fitting lab. In this area, we're able to lift up pipe so they can lift it up properly, show them how to fit it together. So this is all done to teach people rigging certification.
Broadbent is the business manager for Steamfitters Union 449. He's showing off his union's brand new training center about a half an hour north of Pittsburgh. Through a door, he walks into another room.
In here. This is the weld shop, 66 weld booth.
Each weld booth is a little like an old-fashioned voting booth. Apprentices practice welding pipes together behind orange plastic curtains that shield the bright lights of their torches.
Welding is like shoot and pull. The more you do it, the better you get at it. So the more welds you can make, the better you're going to get.
This training center opened last year. It cost the union $18.5 million to build. But Broadbent says it's money well spent. His members will have plenty of work in the oil and gas business over the next few years. They'll be working on natural gas processing plants, power plants, and Shell's multi-billion dollar ethane cracker in Beaver County, which will employ 1,500 steam fitters at peak construction.
So I'm almost going to double the amount of people when it peaks working out of my union.
That is good for our education fund. That's good for our health coverage. It helps us stay in business.
The industry's relationship with labor unions wasn't always this close, Broadbent says. When the shale gas boom hit Pennsylvania 10 years ago, many of the companies who came to the region were from right-to-work states like Texas and Oklahoma.
A lot of times they don't know how to work with labor unions or think that they might not be in their best interest.
Nationwide, fewer than 5% of workers in oil, gas, and mining are unionized, about half the national average. But as the fracking boom has grown in Pennsylvania, the industry has turned to organized labor to build large infrastructure projects, like Shell's ethane cracker or Sunoco's 300-mile-long Mariner East 2 pipeline. While that's been good for unions, industry critics say that could be bad for Pennsylvania. Doug Shields works for the environmental group Food and Water Watch.
When I read that Sunoco had pledged to build the Mariner 2 all union, I go, well, there goes any possibility of dissent or constructive concern over the environmental impacts with regard to the Democratic caucus and the assembly.
Shields was a Democratic city councilman in Pittsburgh and has been an active critic of fracking for years. He says while the oil and gas industry is a big political donor for Republican candidates, unions fulfill a similar role for Democrats. And he thinks Pennsylvania's Democrats will be hesitant to impose tough environmental regulations if it means slowing down gas development. Shields points to the Department of Environmental Protection's approval of the Mariner East pipeline under Governor Tom Wolf. Critics say that approval was rushed, and the project has had dozens of spills and other violations during construction. Shields worries Democratic leaders will rush similar decisions.
Particularly those in the leadership side. They may well recognize the problems, but they also understand very, very well what side the bread is buttered on. And to become adverse to the labor interest in their quest for a job would be suicidal.
A review of campaign finance records by State Impact Pennsylvania and the Allegheny Front found trade unions gave over $3 million last year to Wolf's $11 million campaign war chest for 2018. Several unions working on gas projects have already upped their donations to Governor Wolf's campaign compared to the last time he ran in 2014. Pittsburgh's Operating Engineers Union, which is working on Shell's ethane cracker, has already doubled its donations from the last election cycle. The union's leader says that's mainly an attempt to stop potential Republican nominee Scott Wagner, a state senator who's been critical of unions. But he says it also helps that Wolf is favorable to natural gas development. Wolf did not respond to interview requests, but in a statement, a spokesman said the governor takes a, quote, balanced approach to natural gas, meeting with a variety of constituents on the subject. Broadbent's union, the Steamfitters, gave Wolf's campaign $72,000 last year, or more than half of what it gave in the entire 2014 election cycle. Broadbent says his union's donation policy is pretty simple. It gives money to candidates that will help its members.
Most of the labor unions are proactive and will know that they need to support politicians not only with PAC money, but door knocking, phone calling, making sure our members get out and vote. You can't have legislation that affects you.
Often these issues are workforce related, like prevailing wage or unemployment insurance laws. But that can also include laws that could hurt businesses they depend on. In February, the Steamfitters threw a fundraiser for Wolf at their Pittsburgh Union Hall. Before the fundraiser, they sat down with the governor and other union leaders. But they also invited a few other guests, officials from the Marcellus Shale Coalition, the state's natural gas trade group. It was the first face-to-face meeting between the coalition president, Dave Spiegelmeyer, and Governor Wolf since Wolf was elected in 2014. Spiegelmeyer said he felt he was honored to be a guest of the trade unions.
They made sure the governor knew that this industry was important to them and that he needed to help make sure there was a proper climate for folks to invest capital because it was their jobs at risk if that's not the case.
It's not clear what effect the meeting had on Wolf or whether it would steer his policies. His campaign leads all Republican challengers in fundraising, and he's running unopposed in the May Democratic primary. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
In 1984, Congress created the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. And now they support conservation work with grants in all 50 states and in U.S. territories. A relatively new initiative is underway in western Pennsylvania. It's a business plan to restore healthy forests and freshwater habitat in key areas of the region by working with private and public partners. It's funded by the Richard King Mellon Foundation, which we should say also supports the Allegheny Front. To find out more about the plan, I talked with Amanda Basso, director of the Northeastern Regional Office. How are we doing as a region on conservation? Why is this effort, this plan, needed?
The region in general, Western Pennsylvania in particular, but also really the Central Appalachian region, is hugely biologically diverse. It's the terminus of the last glacial extent, which means that it has more biodiversity really than places north of it do because of the impact of the glaciers. So it has, you know, incredibly rich and diverse salamander populations, for example, and freshwater mussel populations. And in the mid-Atlantic, it's really the healthiest, strongest populations of eastern brook trout, which is a species that's representative of the health of our cold water streams and a, you know, super popular sport fishing fish as well. So it's just, it's a really important area where we've been trying to actually put together a partnership for quite some time.
So what is the strategy? Give us an overview.
Well, the approach we took was that we knew that we wanted to focus on healthy forest systems and healthy freshwater systems. And so we identified a handful of species that, through talking to experts and local folks on the ground in western Pennsylvania, species that if they were there, you could be pretty sure that the forest system was healthy or the freshwater system was healthy. And so the suite of species we came up with included on the forest side, American woodcock and golden-winged warbler, which are two species that really specialize in young forest habitat and shrublands habitat. The black-throated blue warbler, which is kind of a bird that specializes in healthy middle-aged forests. And then the cerulean warbler, which really needs a mature forest with some diversity of habitat within that mature forest. On the freshwater side, we looked at eastern brook trout. Eastern brook trout like a really clean, cold, fast-moving stream. And that's a healthy stream that's going to meet the needs of a lot of different species. And then eastern hellbender, they like bigger water bodies, but they also need clean water and big boulders to hide under. Again, good indicators of water quality and the healthy stream system. And then freshwater mussels, which really are indicators of good water quality, but also each different species of mussel has a host fish species that moves its spat. And so in order to have a diverse and rich population of freshwater mussels, you also have to have a diverse population of fish. So it's a really good indicator of whether you've got a healthy system that's got a lot of different kinds of fish. So those were for the freshwater system. And then we also identified the Louisiana water thrush, which is a bird that really occupies the streamside forest habitat as a species that would make the connection between the upland healthy forest and the aquatic system. So those were the species that we identified that if we had those, there was a pretty good chance that the system was healthy. And then what we did was we mapped where there was good habitat for these species, where there was habitat that had good potential to be quality habitat for these species, but where there might be some threats that were at play that were limiting the success of the species right now. And so we mapped all of that out, and then we identified sort of what we felt were the best opportunities to invest grant funding on the ground where there were grantees that were active and had the capacity to get work on the ground.
Yeah, these, I think there are 11 geographical areas within Western Pennsylvania where the restoration work will happen. Can you talk a little bit about the threats part for why there needs to be a restoration project?
Sure. Lots of different things going on the landscape for a long time. We looked at land use change, so where development has fragmented forest systems in particular, where polluted runoff from city streets, from agriculture, from roads, dirt and gravel roads even, has degraded water quality. Western Pennsylvania has tremendous forests. It has really healthy blocks of forest, which is really important. And so we looked at opportunities to reconnect blocks of forest, with wildlife corridors and just more intentional management. We looked at historic mining activities on the land and where were there opportunities to engage in restoration of abandoned mine lands, to restore acid mine drainage on the aquatic habitat side. So really the broad swath of activities going on the land that impact water and forest health.
I was going to ask, you know, why this particular investment in habitat restoration and species conservation is important to Western Pennsylvania and then also in a larger scale.
So you're really asking, well, why I care about conservation, right?
I mean, I guess it's an obvious question, but I mean, you know, when are you trying to sell this kind of an idea to funders, but also to just sort of the general population or to farmers who have to, you know, make sort of changes or improvements on the way they're doing things or, you know, like stakeholders? What do you say?
I think that actually is a really good question. And we have a lot of great partners actually now working with us. The American Forest Foundation, for example, is one of our partners. They are an organization that works exclusively with family woodland owners, family-owned non-industrial forests. And they've done a lot of survey work with that community about what they care about. And they definitely, you know, have an economic interest in managing a forest so that they can meet their long-term economic goals for the land. But they very much value the wildlife in that forest. So it's really an opportunity when we talk to family woodland owners, what our grantees are talking about is, what do you value about your land and how can we help you meet your goals for your land? And most times their goals are actually consistent with our mission and our goals as stated in this business plan. Farmers are the same way. You know, we learned a decade ago that farmers in this region really care about eastern brook trout, and actually a lot of them will talk about how they remember when they used to have eastern brook trout on their land and that they used to like to fish in their favorite fishing hole and that they really like to have eastern brook trout back. And talking to a farmer about eastern brook trout is a much more productive conversation than talking to them about the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay. Wildlife is actually the language that resonates with a lot of private landowners, isn't it? And is a really productive way to start a conversation. But we're always starting the conversation with, what are your goals for your land and what kind of conservation might be complementary and even help you meet those goals.
Amanda Basso is director of the Northeastern Regional Office of the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. She says since the Western Pennsylvania program launched last year, they've awarded more than $1.7 million in grants, including funding to open up 170 miles of habitat to eastern brook trout. There's more about all of that at AlleghenyFront.org. And this interview is just the start of a new series of wildlife and conservation stories that we're working on right now. We're calling it Wild PA. Interested in bats? There will definitely be bat stories. So listen for that and other wildlife stories in the coming weeks. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.